Hello, welcome to Activation Energy, a podcast where we discuss health, medicine, and social justice. I'm Jenny.
And I'm Rachel, and we are your hosts today. Thank you for tuning in.
Thank you for joining us. Today we'll be talking with Dr. Katrina Korfmacher about wastewater surveillance research and COVID-19. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. I'm really glad to be here.
Okay. Could you introduce yourself briefly?
Sure. So my name is Katrina Smith Korfmacher, and I am a professor of environmental medicine, and I direct the Community Engagement Corps here at the University of Rochester's Environmental Health Sciences Center.
Okay, let's just start by, could you define what wastewater-based epidemiology is, and historically, how has it been used to inform public health decisions?
Sure. Well, I first learned about wastewater-based epidemiology or wastewater surveillance a couple of years ago at a public health conference. And I actually was trained in environmental management and ecosystems and water resources. So the idea that we could learn about a population's health by testing its wastewater was really exciting. So if you think about it, in our infrastructure for collecting sewage and wastewater from buildings all ends up at wastewater treatment plants, and that's where the waste is treated before being discharged into the water. So it's like a massive collection system that's collecting samples from everybody in a population. So it's been used for taking advantage of that. Several different public health campaigns have been instituted based on wastewater surveillance, most notably monitoring the eradication of polio. But it's also been used for things like community drug testing, so testing for opioids and other chemicals in the wastewater from a community to get a sense of how prevalent those drugs or an infection or something else that's in the wastewater is.
That's very interesting. I feel like it's a source of information that we don't usually think that much about. And I understand that wastewater monitoring wasn't a research focus of yours prior to COVID. So how did you get more involved in this area in the last year?
Well, there are a couple of answers to that question. And the main one was when the pandemic started, I think many of us had an impulse that we wanted to do something helpful. And I'm not a clinician, so I couldn't protect patients, and I'm not in the public health department, so I couldn't work on contact tracing. But I have this background in water resources, and I'm sitting in an environmental health center. So I was trying to think of things that we could do that would contribute to protecting the community's health, and started reading headlines about how in Europe, particularly, wastewater and public health agencies were working together to test the wastewater coming out of communities for COVID. And it turns out that the COVID virus is not very resilient in the environment, so it dies pretty quickly when it's in wastewater. But its RNA is really durable, so it makes its way all the way through the sewage system to the wastewater treatment plant and can be tested there. So when I started reading about that in headlines, I thought, I wonder if that could be implemented here in Rochester and whether that could help with public health surveillance and protecting communities, especially because those communities that had highest rates of COVID were the least likely to be tested individually and clinically. So the idea of something that could passively get a sense of where the virus was most prevalent and where it was problematic as a way of overcoming some of the disparities in testing was really exciting.
So I understand you personally convened the Monroe County Wastewater Coronavirus Surveillance Group. Could you talk a bit about how that desire to help translated into the group's efforts and what that process was like?
Oh, that makes it sound a lot more official than it is. So the first story is that we... As a small research university, we learn a lot about what people in very different disciplines are doing. And I knew that we have an engineering professor who makes nanomembranes out of silicon. And they are really good at testing for tiny particles of things like microplastics, and I'd worked with him on that. And I read something in our newsletter that said he was working on adapting those membranes to test for COVID in blood and saliva samples. And I thought, well, if he can do that, I wonder if he could do that for wastewater. And so I called him up and he said, well, we could try, but the first thing we need is some wastewater. So I thought, where are we going to get some wastewater samples? And called up our wastewater treatment plant, and they were really interested in this question too, because several of their employees had gotten COVID and they wondered if it could have been from the wastewater in their plant. And the answer to that is probably no, but they were really intrigued by the idea and more than happy to partner by providing us with some samples. But as we started talking about why we wanted to do this and what we were hoping to learn and what was being done in Europe, they were really intrigued and said, well, if this is something that we could develop and pilot and figure out, so that it is then useful to our public health department. They're really busy right now, but by the time they're ready for it, we'd like to try it out. So they started regularly taking samples and sending them off to a lab in Syracuse, and testing the wastewater coming out of our whole community. And at the same time, all of our colleges in the community were trying to figure out how could they bring students back safely? What was testing going to look like? And if you remember back in the summer of 2020, clinical testing wasn't really well developed. You know, nobody had an idea of how accurate it was going to be. Would it be available? How expensive would it be? How often could you do it? So the colleges were also really struggling to figure out good approaches to, on a smaller scale, figuring out the virus in their communities. So between the wastewater treatment plant and the colleges, we started talking about this process and what we could learn together, because it was a steep learning curve. And that's what we ended up calling our wastewater coronavirus surveillance working group. It just emerged from that group of people all trying to learn together about how we could build the plane while flying it, right? Figure out how to take samples, you know, how accurate they were, or when, what would you do, what could you do with the results? Everything from the most mundane questions of sample collection to statistical analysis.
That sounds like such a cool partnership. How accurately can we detect the coronavirus in wastewater?
Well, we're partnering with a lab in Syracuse, and they've estimated that they can detect COVID RNA in wastewater if there's one case per 10,000.
You mentioned that the virus doesn't actually survive very well in the environment, so that's interesting.
But the RNA does, and so, of course, the more prevalence there is in the population, the more RNA there is, the more accurate the estimates are. And there were efforts going on all over the country to develop different ways of doing the sampling, different ways of doing the testing, figuring out its sensitivity. The lab that we were using here was really focused on finding a way that was going to be affordable and quick so that they could get information back. And their accuracy also, and the sensitivity is quite high. So it turns out that it was really useful even at the dorm level with some of the colleges that adopted it, as well as the community-wide level.
Would you say that wastewater surveillance efforts on campuses in Rochester, I guess, have been successful? Like, have monitoring made a significant contribution to predicting or preventing outbreaks?
That's been one of the most fascinating things about having these weekly conversations with people from health, from environmental services, from the colleges, from the consulting firms, and guests from lots of other communities that want to do similar things. So we ask that question every single week. You know, is this useful? How are you using this information? And the answer has resoundingly been yes, but not in the ways we thought it would. So initially, I think there was sort of a clinical sense that if we could identify which dorms had COVID RNA coming out of them, and then implement student testing there and identify those students and get them out of the dorm, that was the main goal, is to get as accurate as possible. And that has, in fact, happened several times, and been certainly a really important tool for the campuses. But even more than that, it's a different kind of information than they get from sampling students regularly. So even when all of the students on campus were being tested for COVID pretty regularly, having this different source of information to sort of corroborate the trends, to give different information about people who might be coming onto campus who aren't part of the population has been really helpful to them as another source of a different kind of information to complement overall what they are trying to do to protect the student body. And, you know, even anything from messaging to we're seeing increases in the wastewater, so everybody should be extra careful now, to decisions about masking and social distancing, and in one case, even closing the college down.
Oh, wow. You also mentioned that wastewater monitoring has been used at the community level, and I imagine it's quite different implementing it, like, at a very, like, enclosed or contained community like a campus versus outside. So I guess how is that process different, and what is important to consider when scaling operations up?
That's a great question, and one of the themes of my research has been what is it that we can learn about from how colleges have used this information that will help communities use it on a larger scale. And what I mean by that is that a lot of the initial interest in this has been from sort of the engineering and technical perspective, and secondarily from the public health and clinical view. So how do we collect samples? How do we get this information? How do we analyze it and share it? But then from the user perspective, it's really complicated because it's a different kind of information that public health departments are not used to working with, and it's hard to answer questions about how certain is and what does it mean. There's even questions about the ethics of sampling at different levels. And so I think that some of the things we learned from colleges are really applicable to communities as we look to doing it on a broader scale.
That makes a lot of sense. And I understand a lot of your work revolves around the idea of bridging silos, and you recently wrote a book about it. So what do you mean by a silo with respect to environmental health? And are silos a barrier to wastewater monitoring?
Well, so when I talk about silos in the context of environmental health, I'm thinking back to the very origins of public health, right? When everyone who's taken a public health class knows the story of John Snow and the pump, that there was a cholera epidemic in London in the mid-1800s, and he traced it back to the source of one single water pump in the middle of this neighborhood by mapping cases, right? And he recommended taking the pump handle off in the cholera epidemic tied down. And that example shows that public health and environmental health were the same thing. The initial concerns about public health were primarily around environmental sanitation issues, and the solutions were often physical and environmental. But as that discipline developed, we spun off the expertise in management of the environment into engineers who built wastewater treatment plants and drinking water treatment plants and waste collection systems, and all of the agencies and groups that we now have to protect the environment are separate from the way that public health agencies and approaches developed to focus, especially as we mastered sanitation, right, to focus on different things. So now we have agencies, interest groups, experts, educational systems that by and large treat the environment and health separately. Now, when you're talking about something like wastewater surveillance, wastewater treatment plants are governed by our environmental conservation agencies, right? They are there to protect water quality with the ultimate goal of protecting the environment and human health. But the specialists who regulate those under the EPA are trained in environmental sciences. Meanwhile, the concerns and questions we have about infectious disease or opioid use or other community health are governed by our public health agencies and our clinical health system. And they don't have a direct role in how wastewater treatment plants are operated, what's monitored there, and how that information is used. So it's a classic example of these two silos of the information coming from the environmental side and being used by the health side, but we don't have organizations or ways for those two groups to talk together. And that's why we formed this little learning group to talk every week to just try to start creating those bridges.
How do you anticipate that those bridges you mentioned will, what form will they take in some hopefully not so distant post-pandemic future?
That's a great question. And honestly, that's why I've been so excited about this process. Hopefully this pandemic will be behind us before too long. But I also hope that we learn a lot from it. And one of the things that is most powerful, I think, is looking for ways of bridging the public health and environmental concerns around wastewater surveillance, because there will be another pandemic, right? And the same technology could be useful for that. The same technology could be used for monitoring flu, either at the community level or the institutional level. And as I mentioned, with concerns about opioids or other drug use within a population. Once that system is in place, it's possible for it to be used in lots of different ways. So right now, our state health department is supporting creation of a statewide network of wastewater surveillance and has joined the National Wastewater Surveillance System. And it's my hope that those will be fully funded at the federal level and at the state level so that this becomes a practice and that communities like ours can benefit from that going forward.
Wow, that sounds like a very, what am I trying to say?
It would be definitely like a very different way of thinking about pandemics and integrating a new kind of information into solving, addressing them. But when we look at big issues like global pandemics or climate change or even air quality, we need to make better connections between our health agencies and our environmental agencies, our health interests and professionals, and environmental interests and professionals in order to do a better job of solving those problems. And I think you've heard the phrase, your zip code determines your life expectancy, right? And that says that everything in the environment shapes how we live, how well we live, how healthy we are, and how long we live. And we recognize that's a true fact now, right? But it's very difficult to connect that knowledge to action at the local level. So what does that mean? What do we need to change in our environment so that everybody can have an equal chance of living a healthy life? And I think fundamentally reconnecting the environment and health is a key part of that.
Thank you so much for talking with us today and for doing the work you do.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for joining us today. For more like this, please subscribe, and you can find us on Instagram and Twitter.